It's all about the cake. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. An historic meeting in Northern Ireland today, but it's a story about a bakery there that's making the headlines.
It was a gay rights activist who wanted the company to make a cake that included a slogan that said, "Support gay marriage," along with a picture of Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street.
The bakery refused and wound up in court. Sound familiar? Also, CIA interrogators tortured suspects after 9/11 in part because they thought they could, but they didn't ask the deeper question.
Should you have done it? The fascinating thing is they didn't spend a lot of time thinking that.
Plus, blasting space junk with a laser.
It will repeatedly hit it in bursts, so it'd be like a machine gun. Wham, 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 wham.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, this is The World. There's a bit of history waiting to be made in Ireland. On Friday, the Irish will vote in a referendum on gay marriage. And if the polls are correct, Ireland will become the first country to legalize same-sex marriages nationwide via the ballot box. But some observers are warning that not all voters are being honest when asked if they'd vote yes.
Almost certainly going to be a yes, but the shinos, as they're being called in Ireland at the moment, are making a bit of a run.
We'll hear the latest from the Republic of Ireland in just a few minutes. First, we go to Northern Ireland, the part that's still part of the United Kingdom, and a story there that's caught a lot of attention. It's about a bakery. Let me explain. A court in Northern Ireland ruled that a bakery discriminated against customer Gareth Lee because it refused to make Lee a cake with a pro-gay marriage design. That design included the Sesame Street characters Bert and Ernie. Another company ended up baking the cake, but Gareth Lee sued for discrimination, while the Asher's Baking Company claimed religious freedom. Lee won. But the case has divided Northern Ireland. Deborah McLeese is on the story for the Belfast Telegraph. Today she asked people on the street for their gut reactions to the verdict.
You've got different reactions. I mean, you have supporters of Mr. Lee who are very happy. They think that it's common sense that the judge made this ruling. But then you also have a lot of the Christian organisations and supporters of the family-run bakery, as well as some politicians who are saying that they believe it's wrong. They want the judgment to be appealed. And some politicians are even discussing looking at bringing in a conscience clause within legislation here, which would give businesses the right to not fulfill orders on their religious beliefs.
It's interesting because if somebody orders a cake with something written on it, I think the thing that I've always wondered is why a business owner would think that that suggests that they have to believe what they write on the cake if their business is to decorate a cake. Did the court cite that at all in terms of, you know, your business is separate from your beliefs?
Yes, well, they said that the bakery, it's running a business for money and that it's not a religious organization. You know, it's a business that is there to make money and it's offering services to everybody in the community. There's nothing within any of their leaflets or pamphlets that says that they have strongly held Christian beliefs. So the court says that, you know, they're there as a business. They're there to serve everybody within the community.
Here in the States, we had a similar issue with a bakery in Indiana. It's interesting. It always seems to be about a cake. What do you think is going on there?
About a cake? I don't think it's to do about it. I mean, it could have been about a T-shirt printing business or anything like that. I don't think it's anything to do with a cake. You know, I think it's just that Mr. Lee obviously felt so strongly that he took it to the Equality Commission, who then helped him launch legal proceedings. We don't know how many other cases are out there at the minute. You know, I'm sure maybe some, you know, we will have more people possibly coming forward saying that they have been discriminated against. It just happens to have been that this all started with a cake.
Does Northern Ireland kind of feel like it's being kind of beat up on with this issue because it's, you know, more conservative than other parts of the United Kingdom and there's a vote going on on same-sex marriage in the Republic of Ireland? Does it feel like it's being kind of singled out in this case in any way?
I don't know. I mean, maybe if you look at it positively, after, you know, years of just focusing on the troubles. You know, Northern Ireland is now becoming a normalised society, and we're starting to debate a lot of issues that were being debated in other parts of the world while we were still going through the troubles. So in a positive way, I suppose it does show that we are now becoming a normalised society, being able to have these debates. You know, it's no longer just orange versus green politics in Northern Ireland anymore. You know, these are normal issues that we're debating.
Deborah McLeese with the Belfast Telegraph. Okay, back to the Republic of Ireland now, and Friday's referendum there on same-sex marriage. As I mentioned earlier, the polls predict that voters will approve gay marriage by a 2-to-1 margin, no less. But some are warning that the polls may not be telling the whole story on this one, and that the so-called shy no's could influence the outcome. My BBC colleague Andy Martin has been covering the run-up to the referendum.
It had been anticipated in Ireland that there could be as many as 75% of the population that would vote in favour of an amendment to the Irish Constitution. However, that has been narrowing, albeit only slightly, over the last number of weeks. And the most recent poll suggests that that has fallen to between 60 and 70%. And the real anomaly here is between older people and younger people. Among 18 to 24-year-olds, 71% have indicated that they intend to vote yes, and only 15% in that age bracket say that they want to vote no. But if you move to the over 65s, about 52% intend to vote no, and only 34% intend to vote yes. Quite a few are undecided, still about 20% indicate that they're undecided. The feeling amongst pollsters is that that means that they may well vote no, but it still won't be enough to disrupt what all of the political parties and many sports and sports stars and personalities here have been advocating, and that is a change to the Constitution.
So you called them shy no's, and I assume these are the older Irish men and women who may be saying, publicly supporting, but they're going to go in that booth and they're going to vote no.
Well, that's it. And they do take their lead in many instances from the Catholic Church, which is still hugely important in Ireland. Of course, this is a country which has liberalised at a blistering pace over the last number of decades. I mean, this is the country where just a few decades ago, when I was a child, actually, divorce was banned in Ireland. And this is a place where female civil servants, until relatively recently, at the point of marriage, were obliged to relinquish their jobs in the civil service.
Wow.
So Ireland is a hugely cosmopolitan country now, but just a few decades ago, it really did take its lead from the Catholic Church. And so there are many people of that particular generation who still take their lead from the leadership of the Catholic Church, who have been, I suppose, slightly surprisingly quiet on this issue. There has been a change at the top of the Catholic Church, and they have been gently saying, vote no.
How do the demographics work? Are there a lot more young Irish than older Irish?
Unfortunately not. A lot of young Irish have left in recent years because of the economic crash. You'll remember that Ireland was one of the bailout countries that had to be saved by the European Central Bank, the IMF, in order to shore up its finances following the global financial crisis. And as a result of that, up to 350,000 young people left these shores to go predominantly to Australia and Canada, but also to the United States in search of work. So there are fewer people of that age bracket in Ireland than there would have been under normal circumstances. But certainly the older vote is more likely to turn out. Younger voters traditionally in Ireland don't turn out to vote.
Now, you mentioned the big celebrities on board. Tell us about that. They're doing a big yes campaign. Who are the celebrities, and how powerful has that message been?
Of course, Irish rugby has really come to the fore as one of the main sports in Ireland in recent years. Brian O'Driscoll, the recently retired Irish rugby captain, has come out in favour of a yes vote. Mary McAleese, the former president of Ireland, has really broken with tradition and spoken in a political sense, because her son is gay and she has come out and said that she is advocating a yes vote. Also at the top of politics, all of the main political parties are advocating a yes vote. Most notably, I think, the chairman of the leading party, Fine Gael, who is himself a devout Catholic, a devout Christian, but he has done a very compelling interview with the BBC, in which he describes the moment at which his son came out as gay and how he has had to question his faith, and he has come to the view that he has to advocate a yes vote in order to allow his son the same rights as anybody else in terms of marriage. The no voters are far less vocal, I have to say. And as I was trying to indicate earlier, the Archbishop of All Ireland, the Primate of All Ireland, Eamon Martin, has declined to do interviews in the manner that his predecessors might have. And he has spoken more about compassion, and he is taking his lead very much from Pope Francis, who is talking about compassion. But he says that he cannot equate marriage between a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, to a marriage between a man and a woman. And so they are saying that for the sake of the family, they want people to vote no.
My BBC colleague Andy Martin telling us about the run-up to Ireland's referendum on gay marriage. It's the end of an era, the death of an icon. What could cause such an outcry? You may have heard that FAO Schwartz, or Schwarz, as the company calls itself, is closing its flagship store in July. Toys R Us, which owns the iconic brand, cites the rising cost of retail space on New York City's pricey Fifth Avenue. The World's Aaron Schachter has this reflection on a store that was initially just a twinkle in a German immigrant's eye.
First of all, let's get this straight. I've never heard FAO Schwartz called FAO Schwarz, so I'm going to call it Schwartz. After 40 years of saying it wrong, I'm going to keep doing it. 40 years! More, maybe. When I was a kid in suburban New Jersey, my parents used to pack three kids into the car for a little culture in New York City. We'd fight in the car, my parents would gripe about the cost of parking, we'd go to a museum or something, and we'd invariably end up at FAO Schwartz, with its singing clock on the main floor. FAO was tens of thousands of square feet of sheer amazement. There was always a gas-powered Ferrari or Land Rover go-kart with a 5-foot, $500 teddy bear in the driver's seat. FAO was known for its Stiff teddy bears and legions of other stuffed animals. There was every possible board game, action figure, piles of toys from all over the world that you'd never see advertised on Saturday morning cartoons. But here's the best part.
You actually get on the rocking horse and see what it feels like.
You could play with everything, including a giant piano keyboard at the entrance. You were expecting maybe something else? John Nelson is the author of American Folk Toys. He says letting kids play was brilliant marketing.
If you walked in there with your parents and you fell in love with a toy, your parents would probably stretch a bit to get it for you, because there you were playing with it for half an hour, and you obviously had already fallen in love with it or were fascinated by it.
My parents were never able to make that stretch for a toy from FAO Schwartz, and as a parent now, I can only imagine the badgering my mom and dad took to buy us something, anything. German businessman Frederick August Otto Schwartz. Okay, Schwarz opened his first magical toy emporium in the U.S. in 1862 in Baltimore. Over the next 150 years, the store moved up and out, opening a few dozen locations in San Francisco, Las Vegas, here in Boston, among other places, and of course, Fifth Avenue.
If your toy was accepted at FAO, it was the height of your experience as a toy maker.
Steve Ann Auerbach, Dr. Toy, as she's known, wrote a book about FAO's toys. Her family also used to make pilgrimages from Queens, New York, to the big store in Manhattan.
When you've got a new product, you want to test it out. You want to see how to play with it. So this is essential.
But why don't other stores do that?
Well, they're not always run by people who understand the quality of toys. And they don't always, they may be business people that don't really understand children.
But Dr. Toy says FAO Schwartz has fallen victim to a changing industry and shopping habits. She means the internet. The brand's not going away. Its parent company, Toys R Us, says they will open other FAO Schwartz outlets in New York. For The World, I'm Aaron Schachter.
Listening to The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Euphemisms come in handy when you're trying to make something unpleasant seem more acceptable. A prison can also be a correctional facility. Kidnapping can become extraordinary rendition. But perhaps the most chilling euphemism used by U.S. officials in recent years is this one, enhanced interrogation. We all know by now that it's another way of describing techniques widely accepted as torture. A new Frontline documentary premiering tonight explores the secret history of the CIA's enhanced interrogation program. Michael Kirk produced the film. He traces the start of the U.S. interrogation program to the panic just after 9/11, when intelligence officials began to deal with captured al-Qaeda operatives.
They get one in particular, a man named Abu Zubaydah, and they are not satisfied with the information being extracted or gleaned from him by an FBI agent, which is, they think, too soft, too easy, too friendly. It's time to squeeze these guys. And it's under those circumstances that the CIA decides they better go looking for somebody who knows how to interrogate people, and they better go looking for people who know how to get tough.
And they find these two men, the so-called architects of the enhanced interrogation program, retired Air Force psychologist James Mitchell and his partner Bruce Jessen. What's amazing, they were paid $81 million to create this torture program, although neither had any experience as interrogators or had even studied al-Qaeda. We want to play a clip from your film. This is former White House intelligence advisor Philip Zelikow describing them.
Mitchell and Jessen had created interrogation methods inspired by things the North Koreans and Chinese had done in the 1950s. Absurd brainwashing efforts that we had always regarded as emblems of tyranny.
Now, how did they convince people that they were experts?
Well, in the CIA at that time, somebody knows about Mitchell and Jessen, knows that they worked for the Air Force, and wonders whether they might be able to reverse engineer the training they were giving American pilots and other people in the Air Force in case they got captured. The guy who's the sort of main person from the CIA who talks to us, their top lawyer, John Rizzo, then carries a list around with him to get approval from the Office of Legal Counsel, the Justice Department, and from the White House.
They kind of have to seek for a while to get that approval.
It's actually amazing how quickly they get it. It doesn't take more than a couple of weeks, and they have the authority to do 12 things they call enhanced interrogation techniques.
And tell us about those.
The theory was that they would follow these 12 steps. They wrap a towel around your neck and bounce you off a wall a few times, getting your attention. Remember, the end goal is something called learned helplessness, where you'll just be so desperate, you'll do basically anything the interrogator asks you to do. And they then go to tummy slaps or belly slaps, what is really a euphemism for hitting you in the stomach. They can keep you naked. They can strap you up. They can put you in a coffin-sized box. They can put you in a box half the size of a coffin. They can eventually get down to number 12, which is waterboarding, putting a cloth over your face, pouring enough water over your mouth and nose that you believe within about 20 or 30 seconds you are drowning.
A fair amount of evidence has come out about the use of those methods, and the heart of your film is really these twin versions of whether they were effective or not. And what's really interesting is kind of the Catherine Bigelow piece of this. A big Hollywood director is somehow courted by the CIA. You know, the film leaves viewers with the impression that torture's justified because it produced information that saved lives. I'm curious, after documentaries like yours and your own research, does someone like Catherine Bigelow, does she ever think she was sort of snookered by the CIA?
Well, I can't speak for her, but certainly there's evidence that the CIA used her effectively. We have an email, a behind-the-scenes email, where one person at the CIA is saying, we've got to get on this horse, we've got to ride this horse, Catherine Bigelow and Mark Bohl, her co-producer and writer, because there has frankly been a war out there over the history of effective, not effective, and they all saw this and sold this moment where Osama bin Laden was killed as a proof positive that the enhanced interrogation techniques had finally worked, and Bigelow, who had just won an Oscar for Hurt Locker, was a prime target of that effort.
One issue this documentary focuses on and considers one of its key points is, of course, that not only that the enhanced interrogation program didn't work, but it didn't produce any intelligence that stopped an attack. But there's also a separate question of whether torture is ever ethical. I want to play a clip from the film where you confront Deputy CIA Director John McLaughlin about the morality of torture.
On the one hand, we knew this program would be contentious. On the other hand, we asked ourselves, wouldn't it be equally immoral if we failed to get this information and thousands of Americans died? There was another 9/11. How immoral would that be? That's the dilemma we were up against, and we felt a moral commitment to protect the United States.
That is the hardest question I have for anybody on that side of the story. Should you have done it? Because the fascinating thing is they didn't spend a lot of time thinking that. Hopefully for citizens, that is the fundamental question. But for the people in the government worried about a second attack, worried about the continuation of their agency, worried about their own legal liabilities and other things, what they're especially interested in is the can we do it question, not the should we do it question. We did talk to a number of people who said it's too bad that that's not the first question the President of the United States asked at the time.
Filmmaker Michael Kirk's frontline documentary, Secrets, Politics, and Torture, premieres tonight on PBS. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can see a trailer for that frontline documentary at PRI.org. Let's have a quick talk now about space junk. As you probably know, there's lots of garbage orbiting our planet, big pieces of junk, like old satellites and used-up rocket stages, and smaller ones.
There are over 500,000 pieces of debris that are between the size of a cherry and a melon.
Lucy Rogers with the British Interplanetary Society is a top space junk researcher. She told our colleagues at the BBC about the dangers posed by these orbiting fragments.
Something the size of a cherry going at 17,000 miles per hour, which it will be up in space, if that hits a spacecraft, it can have the same effect as a hand grenade going off.
Okay, so why not meet fire with fire? That's what some Japanese researchers want to do. They've made a special telescope that tracks debris from the International Space Station, and they want to pair it with a laser beam that would blast the garbage away, literally.
The laser will focus on a piece of space debris, and it will repeatedly hit it in bursts. So it'd be like a machine gun, wham, 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 hitting the piece of debris. That will increase the temperature on the debris. And just like using a magnifying glass in the sunshine on a piece of wood and the smoke starts curling up, the plasma that will be vaporized from the piece of debris will actually work as thrust, like a rocket thrust, and will push the debris away.
I love the way she says debris. Anyway, don't get too excited. Dr. Lucy Rogers says this laser idea may not fly because of politics.
If you can blast a piece of space debris, you could also blast someone else's satellite. And due to the Star Wars treaties, the no weapons in space treaties that were signed in the 80s, putting a laser into space is causing political problems.
That didn't stop Dr. Evil back in the day.
Using these lasers, we punch a hole in the protective layer around the world, which we call the ozone layer. Slowly but surely, ultraviolet rays and stories increasing the risk of skin cancer.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, a sitar player gets an urgent call from pop star Cyndi Lauper.
She was like, Neil, I need you to play on Letterman, you know, with me tomorrow. And it was pretty exciting.
How an appearance on David Letterman's TV show changed Neil Mergai's career. That story's just ahead, right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Last week, President Obama held a meeting at Camp David with key Arab allies from the Gulf region, at Saudi Arabia's home turf. But the Saudi king passed on the invite. Still, at that summit, the U.S. agreed to new weapons shipments to those Gulf allies. And if you want to see American weapons already in use in the region, check out Yemen. That's where a Saudi-led airstrike campaign has been going on for weeks. Saudi Arabia and many of its neighbors are worried about the advance of Houthi rebels in Yemen. After a brief pause last week, the bombing campaign is back on now. We caught up with one Yemeni who's been tweeting updates since the airstrikes restarted. Hisham Alomesi, you live in Sana'a. How often are you hearing planes overhead or explosions?
Well, for the past almost 16 hours, we're hearing them every 15 minutes. They've been relentless. Since the end of the pause, for the 5 days pause, they've been really coming back at it with a vengeance.
And where are you right now? Where are you speaking to us from?
From a friend's home. We're holed up with other people and waiting for the next airstrike.
And I want to give a sense to our listeners of what daily life is like in Yemen. How do you go about getting basic things like food and water?
Well, that basically in itself is an adventure. Every few days, you have to go out, try to get as much as you can, and get back home. Unfortunately, because of the blockade for the past 2 months, there isn't much that you can get from the market. Yemen imports 90% of its food, so you go to the supermarket and the shelves are empty. You cannot get to the supermarket because there's no gas for transportation, so you either walk or hitchhike from the people that still have some gas.
When you look out your window in Sana'a, what do you see?
What you see is a dead city. People are not moving around because there's no gas, hence no transportation, no cars on the streets. And what you see is just columns of smoke rising to the sky from the continuous airstrikes.
Are you watching television or listening to the radio? I guess what I'm trying to get at is, are you getting updates about what is going on?
Usually, you cannot get TV requires electricity. There hasn't been any power in the capital for the past few weeks. So we rely on our phones. Usually, we just log in into Twitter or Facebook, and we communicate amongst each other. For instance, I live south of the capital. When there's an airstrike near my area, I log in and I update people that the airstrike was in my area. If there are any casualties, if any people are near who can volunteer and help. And that's how we communicate and we exchange information.
Hisham, are you in a position where you need to ration water and basic foodstuffs?
Not just me. It's the whole population that does that. And we've been doing that for the past few weeks.
And do you have children?
Yes, I do have children. I do have two children whom I keep indoors 90% of the time. Of course, schools are closed. They've been closed for the past few months. And you can't take them to any parks. The parks are closed. The businesses are closed. There's no transportation to take them anywhere. And it will be too risky to take them anywhere in the first place because the airstrikes could hit at any moment and they could hit anywhere.
Are you considering leaving Sana'a?
Well, I didn't initially. Now that I'm considering it, I cannot leave anywhere because there's no transportation. The airports have been bombarded, obliterated. Same goes for the seaports. You go to the land ports, and Saudi Arabia does not allow you through the border. So basically, we're boxed in.
Hisham Alomesi is a Yemeni. He's been speaking to us from Sana'a. Hisham, please take care of yourself, and I appreciate you speaking with us.
Thank you.
We often turn to political cartoons from around the world to add some context to the news events we cover. And believe it or not, even a war like the one in Yemen has inspired cartoonists to put pen to paper, especially those in Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Radio Netherlands reporter Yanni Skipper has been reporting out of Saudi Arabia recently. She's fluent in Arabic and has covered the region for several years. So I asked her to tell us how satire is being used to comment on the conflict in Yemen.
Well, Saudi has always been very strong in satire. There are some YouTube shows and many cartoonists who criticize everything that can be criticized in Saudi Arabia. But of course, there are red lines. And with a conflict like this, you see that most cartoonists and satirists turn to the very patriotical point of view where they draw cartoons with Saudi flags, strongly in support of the operation. And it's hard to tell if they do that by their own free will or because there have been warnings not to question this operation.
Are Saudi citizens sort of accepting the patriotic narrative?
They seem to be. Again, there have been warnings from government side that they should also accept this narrative. And as soon as there was a switch from the operation Decisive Storm to restoring hope, there was a little bit more nuance in rhetoric about that.
And Operation Decisive Storm was the initial incursion, and it's starting in March, and Restoring Hope is the new name of it since the ceasefire ended?
Yes, exactly. And of course, the attacks are going on, but the Saudi authorities are really framing it like, now we're going to bring back the hope to the Yemeni people. We're helping the Yemeni people. We're one as an Arab and Muslim nation. Not everyone is buying that in Saudi, obviously, but the criticism is really limited. And what you also see is there's a strong anti-Iran sentiment, which is there in Saudi anyway, and which is now also coming up in satire and cartoons. There are a lot of cartoons criticizing Iran, accusing Iran of interfering in internal affairs in Yemen.
So in the Saudi kind of satirists, it's sort of Iran is the bogeyman, Iran interfering and bringing in aid, but maybe their weapons, those kind of images showing up. I mean, if you take a look at what Yemeni cartoonists or satirists, what they're commenting on, who are the main characters? Who's the good guys and bad guys in what they're drawing?
Well, everyone is the bad guy. It depends a bit on which side you are, obviously. There are people criticizing the Houthis. There are people criticizing the Saudi attacks. There are people criticizing both. A lot of bloody cartoons criticizing the attacks. And a lot of cartoons about internal politics as well, because this has started earlier for the Yemenis, obviously, than it did for the Saudis. So you also see a lot of cartoons warning, aren't we driving towards a civil war? What are the interests behind the fighters in the current conflict? Some say that America and Israel are behind the Houthis. The others saying that America and Israel are behind the Saudis. And so it goes on and on from both sides.
How do Yemeni satirists portray Saudi Arabia in general? Are they kind of like the big bad guy next door who's always going to cause trouble?
Mainly, yes. I didn't come across many cartoons who were like celebrating the Saudi attack. And it varies from really bloody cartoons to just, you know, all the allies are in it for the money. Saudi is the big brother that's actually squeezing our country, trying to do good.
In the Arabian Peninsula, Saudis and Yemenis, the people who are doing things like political cartoons or satire, are they operating most of the time in a separate sphere, sort of online among each other and their followers? Or does it ever appear in mainstream press in a place like Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, you see that some of the Saudi cartoonists especially are operating in both areas and in a different way. I'm sometimes surprised how much a cartoonist like Abdallah Jaber, which is a very popular cartoonist in Saudi Arabia, manages to criticize the whole situation in very subtle ways online on his Twitter account with his followers, and at the same time publishes cartoons in one of the mainstream newspapers, which are a little less on the edge. So he's doing all kinds of things on different platforms, and he seems to get away from it. I know that once on the National Day he tried to publish a cartoon in his newspaper at the time, and then it was refused, but he just published it on Twitter and Facebook, and it went viral, and then still people are getting access to that in other ways.
Yanni Skipper is with Radio Netherlands Worldwide. She's been reporting recently in Saudi Arabia. North and South Korea have a lot to disagree about, but you'd think a shared language would unite them. Not the case, apparently. In fact, the North Korean dialect is sometimes mocked on South Korean TV. Some South Koreans think the way North Koreans speak is old-fashioned. Others think of it as, well, dumb, which is a problem for the nearly 28,000 North Korean escapees who now live south of the border. But there's help, too, as Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
Lee Sung-ju says when he speaks on the phone now, no one can tell he's a North Korean defector. The 28-year-old says when he arrived in South Korea back in 2002, his accent embarrassed him.
I had a really strong North Korean accent. People just keep asking me about my hometown, my background. So whenever I was asked by them, I had to say a lie.
Why were you ashamed?
Man, because I don't want to share my story. People know that North Korea is really poor country.
He says South Koreans would have looked down on him, and he wouldn't have made any friends if they knew he was from the North, so he picked up the local accent pretty fast. Accent differences are just the start of the frustration and confusion that many newly arrived defectors feel here. Sokil Park is with Liberty in North Korea, a refugee support group.
There's been a lot of linguistic change, particularly in the South, with the influence of globalization and the English language in particular. So they arrive here often are surprised with the amount of borrowed words that they're unfamiliar with as soon as they go into a coffee shop, for instance.
For North Korean defectors struggling with South Korea-only words and expressions, there's Yes, a new smartphone app seeking to help bridge the language gap. It's called UniVoca, short for Unification Vocabulary. It allows users to type in or snap a photo of an unknown word, and it gives a North Korean translation. There's also a section that gives practical language advice, like how to order a pizza, and there's a video explaining some dating terminology. One of the app's developers, Jang Jun Chol, explains how they decided on the vocabulary. He flips through a book with highlighted words on some pages. He says they first showed this typical South Korean grammar textbook to a class of teenage defectors who picked out the unfamiliar words. They also consulted older North Koreans to help with translations. So far, they've added about 3,600 words to the app's open-source database. Jung adds before he started working on the app, he never knew how limited North Korean vocabulary is or how some expressions now out of style in the South are still used in the North. I want to get a North Korean's opinion about this translation app, so I ask Lee Song-ju to install it on his phone. We take a walk around a shopping plaza under the Seo Tower, the Koreanized way of saying tower, which seems like a good word to start off with.
So now I'm typing in. In the app, let's say tower. There's no translation for tower.
We pass an ice cream shop. Same word in Korean.
Ice cream.
He types in the word and gets a translation.
They said 얼음 보송이 in North Korean. But we don't use this word when I was in North Korea. We just say ice cream and ice cakey.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Okay, so maybe North Korea doesn't keep out all English words after all. Now we find a donut shop. North Korea can't have a word for donut, can it?
This is correct. In North Korean, it is 가락지빵.
Ring bread.
Yeah, ring bread, yes. But we call 가락지빵 or donut.
Lee says he was skeptical about this app at first, but it won him over.
This is really nice. There are not many functions, but all is very useful for North Korean escapees who just arrived here.
And if the app's developers want to add even more North Korean words, Han Young-un might be able to help them out. He's a South Korean lexicographer who for the past several years has worked with North Korean counterparts to assemble the first unified Korean dictionary. And from what he's learned, he says he doesn't believe that the northern version of Korean is stuck in the past. All languages are living and growing, including North Korean, he says. Over the years, they've borrowed foreign words too, but mostly from Russian and Chinese. For instance, they use the word traktor. Though originally an English word, the North Koreans borrowed it from their Russian communist neighbors. Han adds that political tensions are getting in the way of completing the joint dictionary, but he hopes the project will be wrapped up in a few more years. The big hope is that the dictionary will help unify the peninsula, linguistically, which at the moment seems more likely than political unification. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
We have more on changes in the Korean language in our podcast, The World in Words, including a conversation with a Korean-American who, with her mother, recently returned to Korea after decades living abroad.
My mother, when we lived in Korea back in the 1970s, was actually the news anchor for the nightly news, so she spoke the most standard of Korean possible. But when we arrived in Seoul, there were people there from the start who would say to her, like, where are you from? Where's your accent from? Because she had left the country 35 years ago.
How language evolution leaves people behind. You can listen or subscribe to the World in Words podcast at pri.org/language. This is The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. 6 months ago, two sisters in northern India made headlines when a video of them went viral. It showed the sisters on a bus fighting off three alleged molesters. Questions later arose about what actually happened, and the case still divides opinion in India. I spoke earlier with my BBC colleague, Divya Arya. She recently visited the girls' home village.
Molestation may be fairly common in India's buses and streets and other forms of public transport, but hitting back is what is very unusual, and that is why they became big news here.
At the time of that video going viral and people seeing them in the video hitting back, was the general consensus that this was a good thing and they were celebrated?
Absolutely. They were heroines. Hashtag Rohtak, which is the place where this incident took place, hashtag Rohtak Bravehearts actually trended on Twitter for a really long time. And Rohtak is a very small city and would not make it to Twitter, which is still a very urban, big city phenomenon in India. So that spoke of the kind of recall the incident had with a lot of women in big cities like Delhi, Mumbai, Kolkata, because molestation is something even I have experienced when I went to college and traveled in a bus.
Now, you recently went back to their village, and I know you were able to speak with the girls. What are they doing now?
They're still going to college. They said that they spent a lot of time, making trips to the police station and facing the whole investigation process. The boys against whom the allegation of harassment was made were arrested but let off within a few days. And they're going back to their college as well. So on the face of it, it seems like it's life as usual, but it isn't, because after the first video came another video in which the girls were seen beating up some other man in a park. All kinds of allegations then surfaced, which made them look like girls who just beat up boys for no rhyme or reason. And that has really lowered their credibility in the area they live in. And they say that now, if they're faced with molestation, they probably won't hit back because people don't understand the need to hit back.
So the received wisdom in their own village is suspicion about their original version of what happened?
If you speak to the men in the village, they perceive the incident in one way, in which they say, you know, women beating up men is such a problematic thing. But when you meet the women in the village, they would go out of their way to praise what the girls did. And then in a second instance, they would say, but what was the need to do that? We face harassment every day. They might as well have kept quiet.
Now, the three men who were arrested on charges of sexual harassment and, as you mentioned, later released, you spoke with them. What did they have to say?
They say that there was no harassment at all, that the girls just started beating them up without any reason, which is a bit hard to believe, considering I traveled on that bus myself, and I saw that there was a very, very few number of girls and women in that very crowded bus, which had a lot of men, and I could imagine that molestation could take place. But again, this is a case that is being investigated, and both the girls and the boys have been giving their own version.
When you left their village, were you hopeful at all that something good is going to come out of this?
It's hard to say. The police doesn't help at all. The case has been dragging on. Simple case of molestation. 6 months on, we've seen no headway. So there's no clarity on what the real facts are. But definitely, it's brought out an issue into the limelight, especially in a small village, in the small city that these girls travel to, where women find it really hard to voice any protest against any kind of molestation. And the girls would admit that they feel that somewhere they've made a difference. If a boy again wanted to molest someone on the bus, he would think of that video for a moment, even if they're not being considered the true brave hearts because of, you know, various other allegations coming up. They feel that they've made some difference.
The BBC's Divya Arya speaking to us from Delhi. Thanks so much, Divya.
Thank you.
Finally today, you've heard about David Letterman calling it quits, right? The king of late-night TV is airing his last late-night show tomorrow night. Letterman's retiring after more than 6,000 shows, countless celebrity interviews, and unpredictable comedy. Unpredictable is exactly how Neil Murgai remembers it. The young Indian-American sitar player made his one appearance on The Letterman Show 6 years ago, and it was a memorable one. Neil, how did that happen?
Well, they got in touch with me through a senior musician in the Indian music community. They were looking for a sitarist. So I got a call the day before, and they were like, we need you to play on Letterman tomorrow. And it was actually the day my MFA portfolio thesis was due. So it was just totally insane.
Wow, that was a big day. So how did the gig turn out?
The gig was really fun, actually. The best part was when we were setting up during the commercial break, and I plugged in my sitar, and Paul Schaefer and band was playing Bob Marley's Could You Be Loved. And then I was performing with Wyclef and Cyndi Lauper, actually. And so Wyclef started singing, Could You Be Loved? And I started playing Dunka, 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 Dunka on my sitar. Then Paul Schaefer gave me that look that I've seen him give so many musicians over the years. And he was like, yeah, man. And and he broke the band down, and I was soloing with the band, and it was a really great moment. Then I performed with Wyclef and Cyndi. I guess they wanted some Indian representation. I was very happy to be a part of it.
Wow.
David Letterman, of course, asked me before he introduced Wyclef and Cyndi, he looked over at me and he said, excuse me, can I get you a chair?
You want a chair? Can we get you a chair? I'm sorry. It didn't occur to me. You need a chair? You all right? Okay.
Yeah, no, he's fine.
Where are my manners?
No, he meant to be there. That's where he's supposed to be. Okay.
And I didn't realize he was talking to me for a while. And then I was like, oh, no, I'm good. Because, of course, as a sitarist, we sit on the ground to play. And so he was making light of that and offering me a chair.
You play music now, I understand, with the Brooklyn Raga Massive. What is that?
Basically, a few years ago, we realized that we'd hit critical mass in terms of the number of very talented Indian classical musicians in Brooklyn. So we formed the Brooklyn Raga Massive to harness that power. And we've had a weekly concert series for 3 years running now. And then we have a jam session.
Neil, we're listening to your track called Spaghetti Eastern. What are we hearing here?
Well, this is a song about a funky raga singing cowboy. It's a piece I composed a few years ago. It's kind of catchy, got a little bit funky, but also seems like it could be the soundtrack to like a Western movie somehow.
So I have to ask, have you sent David Letterman a congratulations?
I have not yet. I don't think he would remember me. During the experience of being on the show, the only time I interacted with him was when he asked me for a chair. And then at the end, he also said, shook my hand and said, is that a sitar? Of course, he knew it was a sitar, I'm sure, but he was telling the audience that it was a sitar. But I did grow up watching David Letterman and, loved him. And I used to stay up late to watch his show a lot when I was a kid. So to get to be on the show was a thrill.
Guitar player and composer Neil Mergai. His Spaghetti Eastern closes our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for stopping by.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor, by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, and the Gruber Family Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Tagney Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.